H.P. Lovecraft's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Read and performed by William E. Hart. Chapter 2. An Antecedent and a Horror. 1. Joseph Kerwin, as revealed by the rambling legends embodied in what Ward heard and unearthed, was a very astonishing, enigmatic, and obscurely horrible individual. He had fled from Salem to Providence, that universal haven of the odd, the free, and the dissenting, at the beginning of the great witchcraft panic, being in fear of accusation because of his solitary ways and queer chemical or alchemical experiments. He was a colorless-looking man of about 30, and was soon found qualified to become a freeman of Providence, thereafter buying a home lot just north of Gregory Dexter's at about the foot of Olney Street. His house was built on Stamper's Hill, west of the town street, in what later became Olney Court, and in 1761 he replaced this with a larger one, on the same site, which is still standing. Now the first odd thing about Joseph Kerwin was that he did not seem to grow much older than he had been on his arrival. He engaged in shipping enterprises, purchased wharfage near Mile End Cove, helped rebuild the Great Bridge in 1713, and in 1723 was one of the founders of the Congregational Church on the Hill. But always did he retain the nondescript aspect of a man not greatly over 30 or 35. As decades mounted up, this singular quality began to excite wide notice, but Kerwin always explained it by saying that he came of hardy forefathers and practiced a simplicity of living which did not wear him out. How such simplicity could be reconciled with the inexplicable comings and goings of the secretive merchant, and with the queer gleaming of his windows at all hours of night, was not very clear to the townsfolk, and they were prone to assign other reasons for his continued youth and longevity. It was held, for the most part, that Kerwin's incessant mixings and boilings of chemicals had much to do with his condition. Gossip spoke of the strange substances he brought from London and the Indies on his ships, or purchased in Newport, Boston, and New York, and when old Dr. Jabez Bowen came from Rehoboth and opened his apothecary shop across the Great Bridge at the sign of the Unicorn and Mortar, there was ceaseless talk of the drugs, acids, and metals that the taciturn recluse incessantly bought or ordered from him. Acting on the assumption that Kerwin possessed a wondrous and secret medical skill, many sufferers of various sorts applied to him for aid. But though he appeared to encourage their belief in a non-committal way, and always gave them odd-colored potions in response to their requests, it was observed that his ministrations to others seldom proved of benefit. At length, when over 50 years had passed since the stranger's advent, and without producing more than 5 years' apparent change in his face and physique, the people began to whisper more darkly, and to meet more than halfway that desire for isolation which he had always shown. Private letters and diaries of the period reveal, too, a multitude of other reasons why Joseph Kerwin was marveled at, feared, and finally shunned like a plague. His passion for graveyards, in which he was glimpsed at all hours and under all conditions, was notorious, though no one had witnessed any deed on his part which could actually be termed ghoulish. On the Pawtuxet Road he had a farm, at which he generally lived during the summer, and to which he would frequently be seen riding at various odd times of the day or night. Here his only visible servants, farmers, and caretakers were a sullen pair of aged Narragansett Indians, the husband dumb and curiously scarred, and the wife of a very repulsive cast of countenance, probably due to a mixture of Negro blood. In the lean-to of this house was the laboratory where most of the chemical experiments were conducted. Curious porters and teamers who delivered bottles, bags, or boxes at the small rear door would exchange accounts of the fantastic flasks, crucibles, alembics, and furnaces they saw in the low-shelved room, and prophesied in whispers that the close-mouthed chemist, by which they meant alchemist, would not be long in finding the philosopher's stone. The nearest neighbors to this farm, the Finners, a quarter of a mile away, had still queerer things to tell of certain sounds which they insisted came from the Kerwin place in the night. There were cries, they said, and sustained howlings, and they did not like the large number of livestock which thronged the pastures, for no such amount was needed to keep a lone old man and a very few servants in meat, milk, and wool. The identity of the stock seemed to change from week to week as new droves were purchased from the Kingstown farmers. Then, too, there was something very obnoxious about a certain great stone outbuilding with only high narrow slits for windows. Great Bridge idlers likewise had much to say of Kirwan's townhouse in Olney Court, not so much the fine new one built in 1761, when the man must have been nearly a century old, but the first low gambrel-roofed one with a windowless attic and shingled sides, whose timbers he took the peculiar precaution of burning after its demolition. Here there was less mystery, it is true, but the hours at which lights were seen, the secretiveness of the two swarthy foreigners who comprised the only men-servants, the hideous indistinct mumbling of the incredibly aged French housekeeper, the large amounts of food seen to enter a door within which only four persons lived, and the quality of certain voices often heard in muffled conversation at highly unseasonable times, all combined with what was known of the Pawtuxet Farm to give the place a bad name. In choicer circles, too, the Kirwan home was by no means undiscussed, for as the newcomer had gradually worked into the church and trading life of the town, he had naturally made acquaintances of the better sort, whose company and conversation he was well fitted by education to enjoy. His birth was known to be good, since the Kirwans or Corwins of Salem needed no introduction to New England. It developed that Joseph Kirwan had traveled much in very early life, living for a time in England and making at least two voyages to the Orient, and his speech, when he deigned to use it, was that of a learned and cultivated Englishman. But for some reason or other, Kirwan did not care for society. Whilst never actually rebuffing a visitor, he always reared such a wall of reserve that few could think of anything to say to him which would not sound inane. There seemed to lurk in his bearing some cryptic, sardonic arrogance, as if he had come to find all human beings dull through having moved among stranger and more potent entities. When Dr. Checkley, the famous wit, came from Boston in 1738 to be rector of King's Church, he did not neglect calling on one of whom he soon heard so much, but left in a very short while because of some sinister undercurrent he detected in his host's discourse. Charles Ward told his father, when they discussed Kirwan one winter evening, that he would give much to learn what the mysterious old man had said to the sprightly cleric, but that all diarists agree concerning Dr. Checkley's reluctance to repeat anything he had heard. The good man had been hideously shocked, and could never recall Joseph Kirwan without a visible loss of the gay urbanity for which he was famed. More definite, however, was the reason why another man of taste and breeding avoided the haughty hermit. In 1746, Mr. John Merritt, an elderly English gentleman of literary and scientific leanings, came from Newport to the town which was so rapidly overtaking it in standing, and built a fine country seat on the neck in what is now the heart of the best residence section. He lived in considerable style and comfort, keeping the first coach and liveried servants in town, and taking great pride in his telescope, his microscope, and his well-chosen library of English and Latin books. Hearing of Kirwan as the owner of the best library in Providence, Mr. Merritt early paid him a call, and was more cordially received than most other callers at the house had been. His admiration for his host's ample shelves, which besides the Greek, Latin, and English classics were equipped with a remarkable battery of philosophical, mathematical, and scientific works, including Paracelsus, Agricola, Van Helmont, Sylvius, Glauber, Boyle, Boerhaave, Becker, and Stahl, led Kirwan to suggest a visit to the farmhouse and laboratory whither he had never invited anyone before, and the two drove out at once in Mr. Merritt's coach. Mr. Merritt always confessed to seeing nothing really horrible at the farmhouse, but maintained that the titles of the books in the special library of thaumaturgical, alchemical, and theological subjects which Kirwan kept in a front room were alone sufficient to inspire him with a lasting loathing. Perhaps, however, the facial expression of the owner in exhibiting them contributed much of the prejudice. The bizarre collection, besides a host of standard works which Mr. Merritt was not too alarmed to envy, embraced nearly all the cabalists, demonologists, and magicians known to man, and was a treasure house of lore in the doubtful realms of alchemy and astrology. Hermes Trismegistus in Maynard's edition, the Turba Philosophorum, Geber's Liber Investigationis, and Artefius's Key of Wisdom all were there, with the Kabbalistic Zohar, Peter Jammy's set of Albertus Magnus, Raymond Lully's Ars Magna et Ultima in Zettner's edition, Roger Bacon's Thesaurus Chemicus, Flood's Clavis Alchemiae, and Trithemius's De Lapide Philosophical crowding them close. Medieval Jews and Arabs were represented in profusion, and Mr. Merritt turned pale when, upon taking down a fine volume conspicuously labeled as the Qanun-i-Islam, he found it was in truth the forbidden Necronomicon of the mad Arab Abdul al-Hazred, of which he had heard such monstrous things whispered some years previously after the exposure of nameless rites at the strange little fishing village of Kingsport in the province of the Massachusetts Bay. But oddly enough, the worthy gentleman owned himself most impalpably disquieted by a mere minor detail. On the huge mahogany table there lay face downward a badly worn copy of Borellus, bearing many cryptical marginalia and interlineations in Kerwin's hand. The book was open at about its middle, and one paragraph displayed such thick and tremulous pen strokes beneath the lines of mystic black letter that the visitor could not resist scanning it through. Whether it was the nature of the passage underscored, or the feverish heaviness of the strokes which formed the underscoring, he could not tell, but something in that combination affected him very badly and very peculiarly. He recalled it to the end of his days, writing it down from memory in his diary and once trying to recite it to his close friend Dr. Checkley till he saw how greatly it disturbed the urbane rector. It read, "The essential salts of animals may be so prepared and preserved that an ingenious man may have the whole Ark of Noah in his own study, and raise the fine shape of an animal out of its ashes at his pleasure. And by the like method from the essential salts of humane dust, a philosopher may, without any criminal necromancy, call up the shape of any dead ancestor from the dust whereinto his body has been incinerated." It was near the docks along the southerly part of the town street, however, that the worst things were muttered about Joseph Kerwin. Sailors are superstitious folk, and the seasoned salt who manned the infinite rum, slave, and molasses sloops, the rakish privateers, and the great brigs of the Browns, Crawfords, and Tillinghasts, all made strange furtive signs of protection when they saw the slim, deceptively young-looking figure with its yellow hair and slight stoop entering the Kerwin warehouse in Doubloon Street or talking with captains and supercargoes on the long quay where the Kerwin ships rode restlessly. Kerwin's own clerks and captains hated and feared him, and all his sailors were mongrel riffraff from Martinique, St. Eustatius, Havana, or Port Royal. It was, in a way, the frequency with which these sailors were replaced which inspired the acutest and most tangible part of the fear in which the old man was held. A crew would be turned loose in the town on shore leave, some of its members perhaps charged with this errand or that, and when reassembled it would be almost sure to lack one or more men. That many of the errands had concerned the farm on the Pawtuxet Road, and that few of the sailors had ever been seen to return from that place, was not forgotten. So that in time it became exceedingly difficult for Kerwin to keep his oddly assorted hands. Almost invariably, several would desert soon after hearing the gossip of the Providence wharves, and their replacement in the West Indies became an increasingly great problem to the merchant. In 1760, Joseph Kerwin was virtually an outcast, suspected of vague horrors and demoniac alliances which seemed all the more menacing because they could not be named, understood, or even proved to exist. The last straw may have come from the affair of the missing soldiers in 1758, for in March and April of that year, two royal regiments on their way to New France were quartered in Providence, and depleted by an inexplicable process far beyond the average rate of desertion. Rumor dwelt on the frequency with which Kerwin was wont to be seen talking with the red-coated strangers, and as several of them began to be missed, people thought of the odd conditions among his own seamen. What would have happened if the regiments had not been ordered on, no one can tell. Meanwhile, the merchant's worldly affairs were prospering. He had a virtual monopoly of the town's trade in saltpeter, black pepper, and cinnamon, and easily led any other one shipping establishment save the Browns in his importation of brassware, indigo, cotton, woolens, salt, rigging, iron, paper, and English goods of every kind. Such shopkeepers as James Green, at the sign of the Elephant in Cheapside, the Russells, at the sign of the Golden Eagle across the bridge, or Clark and Nightingale at the Frying Pan and Fish near the new coffee house, depended almost wholly upon him for their stock, and his arrangements with the local distillers, the Narragansett dairymen and horse breeders, and the Newport candle makers made him one of the prime exporters of the colony. Ostracized though he was, he did not lack for civic spirit of a sort. When the colony house burned down, he subscribed handsomely to the lotteries by which the new brick one, still standing at the head of its parade in the old Main Street, was built in 1761. In that same year, too, he helped rebuild the Great Bridge after the October gale. He replaced many of the books of the public library consumed in the colony house fire and bought heavily in the lottery that gave the muddy Market Parade and deep rutted Town Street their pavement of great round stones with a brick footwalk or causey in the middle. About this time, also, he built the plain but excellent new house whose doorway is still such a triumph of carving. When the Whitefield adherents broke off from Dr. Cotton's Hill Church in 1743 and founded Deacon Snow's church across the bridge, Kerwin had gone with them, though his zeal and attendance soon abated. Now, however, he cultivated piety once more, as if to dispel the shadow which had thrown him into isolation and would soon begin to wreck his business fortunes if not sharply checked.